Good evening and welcome to the American Herbalist Guild Professional Herbal Training Webinars. These programs are being brought by the American Herbalist Guild and Association of Herbal Practitioners. And tonight we have a special presentation from the president of the American Herbalist Guild, Karthapurk Singh Khalsa, or KP Khalsa, on fibromyalgia, natural methods, and novel approaches. And KP is a recognized expert on this field. He's written a book and has some tremendous information to share with you this evening. So, Karthapurk, I'm going to give you the controls and you can take it away from here.
Thank you, Stephen. Hello, everyone. Hope you're all having a good evening. We're going to have a rapid-paced informative presentation tonight. So before we start, let me tell you all that there's more information in this webinar than we can discuss in detail. So we're going to be posting this webinar for you to access shortly after we finish tonight, and I'd ask you to go back for some of the details. So since that detail is going to be available to you, I will endeavor to cover as much as possible rather than going into detail about each one. But we will have a question session at the end, and you're welcome to ask whatever questions you can, and we'll do what we can. Okay, so there's me. And I'm – well, we're – there we go. All right. So I've been in the natural healing field for 40 years. Stephen said I'm currently the president of the American Herbalist Guild. This, Stephen, we're having a little bit of technical glitch here.
KP, it's sometimes
not advancing.
Yeah, that's one of the things. Sometimes the slides take a moment to advance, depending how many people are on the webinar. But
this is longer than a moment.
Yeah. Do you want me to see if I can make it advance faster?
Yeah.
There we go.
All right. So I am a dietitian nutritionist and, of course, an herbalist. And tonight's topic, as we all know, fibromyalgia. So I want to talk about pain first here, which, of course, is what fibromyalgia is all about. These controls are a little persnickety. I'd like to be able to advance them myself. All right. So I just want to encourage you to understand that pain is a very serious disorder, and we have a lot of dysfunctional thinking about pain in our culture on both ends of the spectrum. But from the natural healing point of view, I want you to be very comfortable that there are a lot of things that we can do for pain, including natural medicines plus diet and body work kinds of approaches. One of the important things about this condition, fibromyalgia, is that it mimics many other different kinds of conditions. So it's very important that we go through a process of differential diagnosis that will allow us to confirm exactly what's going on and really treat appropriately. In our field, we don't care that much about the name. We care about what we're doing for the individual, so it's not that critical whether we achieve an official fibromyalgia diagnosis, but we want to exclude other possibilities for disorders that may also be causing pain or other symptoms. When we're dealing with pain disorders, there are a number of ways that we can approach them, and each of these approaches probably would be appropriate in some circumstance. There's no particular right way to do it. One of the things we can do is to actually suppress the pain using analgesics. That's not typically the natural healing approach or the ideal way to do it, but of course in our culture where people are used to rapid-acting drugs, analgesics might be appropriate. Ultimately, we want to treat the underlying cause and restore a person to health. If inflammation is present, we can treat that. Fibromyalgia is not an inflammatory disease, however, so not much emphasis on inflammation tonight. From the Asian perspective, pain is considered to be an energy blockage, and so the Asian approach, both Ayurveda and TCM, is to use energy movers, things that promote the movement of energy through the area of pain blockage, and we'll discuss a few of those here in a moment tonight. because in our culture, people are used to rapid and effective drugs for pain, and because fibromyalgia is such a serious life-altering condition, often the things we need to do to help people get back on their feet and recover are very substantial lifestyle changes, and compliance is going to be the secret to everything. And so probably in your clinical experience dealing with fibromyalgia, it's going to be 10% being an effective technician, which we can teach you to do, and 90% all the other social, political, economic, family, relationship kinds of issues that come into play when a person has a total system crash and a chronic degenerative disease. Pain is just the start of fibromyalgia, and pain involves so many lifestyle factors, from toxicity in the tissues to the sedentary life making the pain worse. It's just a never-ending circle of just a mess, really. And ultimately, we have to somehow find the thin end of the wedge to begin to give people the resources they need to get well in this situation and address many different of these factors. Again, you can go back to some of these more extensive charts when we repost this. Ultimately, pain becomes the central focus of that person's life, and they start making their decisions based on their pain experience. As people experience chronic pain in their life, it leads them to be immobile, and fear of having more pain from movement is one of the big issues. Of course, it's going to be depressing to have a painful condition. People end up being re-injured because of their pain, so-called pain behaviors, and people have anxiety about their future. The kinds of people that tend to develop fibromyalgia are people who tend to be anxious anyway. So it's, again, just another way to understand that cycle. Ultimately, what we want to do is perform a very good assessment using whatever tools you have from conventional medicine or alternative treatments, finding the actual cause of the pain. If you can treat the symptoms, so much the better, using things like analgesics if inflammation is present and treating spasm, and of course in the long term get down to the causes and help people manage their lifestyle so that they don't recreate this disease again. Stress has a tremendous effect on this whole situation, and we definitely want to reduce stress to help reduce the pain. One of the things that people often find very effective in fibromyalgia is to adjust their diet. Food allergies are very much a part of the whole syndrome. Food sensitivities, multiple chemical sensitivities, a whole part of this scenario. So people often have success with what's variously called an oligoantigenic diet or a challenge elimination diet. And the idea there is to identify the foods that are exacerbating the symptoms. A good way to do that is to use what's called the few foods diet, which is to limit the diet to a very few hypoallergenic foods, stay on that diet for a couple of weeks to get a complete washout, and then re-challenge with possible allergic foods. When a person has a reaction, eliminate those foods from the diet. Now, that's not a great long-term strategy as a way to live your life, and that certainly doesn't represent a fully healed person, but it's a good starter to help people take some of the pressure off their life and begin to respond to your treatment. So these are the kinds of things that are often involved in the few foods diet. Boring, but effective. So here's what a hypoallergenic dinner might look like: sweet potato, chard, vegetables. Green vegetables are particularly unlikely to cause sensitivity, and they are anti-inflammatory. So if there's any anti-inflammatory component to the chronic pain, green vegetables are a good thing to include in the diet in whatever form. Bitter melon, a vegetable you might know, particularly anti-inflammatory and cooling. Now, we will in a moment mention that fibromyalgia is a cold disease, and the people that tend to develop fibromyalgia are people who are metabolically or constitutionally cold. So we need to be a little careful using things that are cooling. So bitter melon, quite bitter and cooling, but very detoxifying as a food. Most concentrated way to get in bitter melon juice, and we see a couple raw bitter melons here in the picture, would be to juice the bitter melon, knock it back, and you're done. Although they do taste good if you want to include them in your food. Very, very bitter. Cherries have a long history of benefit with joint pain, another thing you might consider. ghee is the ultimate anti-inflammatory remedy in Ayurveda, and from the Ayurvedic perspective, we're talking about a vata disease that affects mainly vata constitution people. Ghee is going to be good for those people as well. The anti-inflammatory benefits from getting essential fatty acids from foods like nuts, always a good idea. Sesame seeds, great source of those things. We don't usually see these black sesame seeds in our culture, but in Asian healing systems, they're considered to be superior to the white sesame seeds and easily available from Asian markets or macrobiotic sources, big in Ayurveda as well. Let's talk about a few herbs in general that benefit the musculoskeletal system, and then we'll work our way down to specifics about fibromyalgia. Myrrhgum, profoundly anti-inflammatory, analgesic, and detoxifying. So I'm going to let you folks download this webinar from our site, and we'll inform you of that to get all these details of scientific names and doses and things when you get the chance to do that. Myrrh trees. A boswellia, another product closely related to myrrh, anti-inflammatory gum. Ginger root, as we know, warming, has an affinity for the joints, great choice in fibromyalgia in particular, used in osteoarthritis, that sort of thing. Use it in cooking, use it as a medicine. Here's one that's going to be familiar to all you TCM practitioners, but probably not so much to the rest of us. Nototurgium root is a workhorse remedy in Chinese herbalism. You see it showing up in formulas all the time. It's cheap, easily available, a great herb to know about. It has an affinity for the musculoskeletal system. It's going to look like this sliced in the Chinese herb store. So nototurgium has a dispersing action which helps with pain. It's going to enhance perspiration, so it's going to pacify vata from the Ayurvedic perspective and unblock these painful obstructions. Nototurgii is particularly appropriate for cold pain and has an affinity for the upper part of the body, especially the shoulder. So that would be a key for you when your client says, my shoulder is the kind of the spot that really is always bothering me. You can think nototurgium and use 3 to 12 grams a day. Ginkgo is a great choice for an herb to enhance circulation that is not particularly heating if you need that kind of scenario. Let's move on to some acute pain remedies, some of which will be very applicable in fibromyalgia. As we'll see in a moment when we dive into this whole thing, the fibromyalgia world is huge, and we need to have a large toolkit to be able to treat all the cases that we're going to see. So our first category is salicylates that have an aspirin-like action. Many plants contain salicylates. We'll name a couple of the main ones here. White willow would be the main one that Western herbalists would know. Willow grows on every continent. Willow is a great short-term pain reliever, and many times it can work quite well in fibromyalgia. The disadvantage is that it's very cold and bitter, which is not so great for these cold people that have the disorder. Ounces tea would be a good dose. This is what willow bark is going to look like when you buy it from the herb store to brew for tea. Meadowsweet, a European plant containing salicylates, very good alternative choice. The effective action is about the same as willow bark, but in any given individual, it may work a little better. Meadowsweet is really easy on the gut. That's nice. Usually available to us as tincture because it is a European plant. My daily dose suggestion is 15 to 30 milliliters. Category of painkillers used all over the world, opioids. We don't have access to things made from opium per se in our culture, but we do have some close cousins that work very well. Opiate products are particularly appropriate for fibromyalgia. People with these cold, dry bodies tend to do very well with opiates. Opiates are warming, and the human body tolerates opiates really well. So California poppy from right where I live here in Oregon. And we can use that as a tea, or it's available as tincture. Works very well. Ounce a day is tea. Cordalis is a Chinese herb that's quite equivalent. It's mildly warming, works very rapidly. It's a great analgesic. Opiates are all sedating, and that's their disadvantage. They have a relatively short duration of about 4 hours of action, so they need to be administered frequently. Cordalis works exceptionally well. In fibromyalgia, as a tea, it's very bitter. Many people find that they can use capsules, and the dose is still reasonable to apply in capsule form. Even 2, 3, 4 double ought capsules every 4 hours gives people some nice pain relief sometimes. And, of course, poppy seed, very familiar to all of us, roughly equivalent to these other two. A typical dose would be about 1 ounce, which is about 4 tablespoons, brewed as tea. Works very quickly, short duration of action. These are the three main opioid substances that we would have in our culture. Chilies are quite pain-blocking and very worth thinking about. Chilies block substance P in the nervous system, the neurotransmitter that helps transmit pain, so often work quite well. Of course, the very spicy, and that's the issue in terms of the dose and the digestive tolerance. Cayenne is also very drying. Cayenne is a pretty extreme herb, and the kind of Vata people that tend to have fibromyalgia often have difficulty with it because of its extreme heating and drying nature. So to be careful with it, but in the right case, it can be very effective. Chinese wild ginger, again, very familiar to you TCM folks, a warming remedy with a joint affinity, great choice for fibromyalgia to treat pain quickly. It disperses cold for joint pain. A typical dose would be about 1 to 4 grams a day. It's decocted in TCM. You can use it in powder form, capsules, whatever, and it's likely to work quite well. Now, asarum, or Chinese wild ginger, is sort of a mildly toxic herb and has some FDA issues, so there may be some availability problems. Some analgesics that are particularly effective at being mildly warming, Google gum, again, close relative of myrrh and boswellia that we talked about before, works quite well for fibromyalgia. One concern about Google is that it's deeply detoxifying. Ayurveda says that it scrapes the channels. It really gets deep into all the tissues. It's profoundly detoxifying. It's not a rebuilding herb. So for people with this catabolic kind of situation and this wasting syndrome in their body that's already not very robust can be a bit of a problem. So you have to watch that you're not creating more catabolism in their kind of situation. So available in capsule form, usually. Google Lipid is a standardized preparation, standardized to Google Sterones. This can work well. Google Sterones are the active ingredient, but that pumps up the cost for, in my opinion, no particular benefit. If it does work, and if that's what you want to use, there's no problem with that other than the cost. Yogaraj Google is an Ayurvedic combination that combines Google gum, the anti-inflammatory, analgesic, deeply detoxifying gum, with a few other ingredients that balance its energetics a little better and make it a better long-term choice. If you're going to administer Google for months at a time, a good idea to use a more well-balanced, blended form. These are the ingredients in Yogaraj Google. We won't dwell on those now, but you'll have that for your records, and you can see that there are a bunch of warming digestion enhancers. Here's another Google formula from Asia that has a particular affinity for the musculoskeletal system and widely used for conditions like this. Again, primarily a detoxifier, but its action is directed more to the muscular system, Kaishor Google. Again, the usual suspects in terms of active ingredients. Turmeric. Many of you know it's my favorite herb, a relatively mild herb, has some analgesic properties, mainly known for being anti-inflammatory, it's detoxifying, and a good choice to consider all the way around in this condition. Curcumin, the active ingredient in turmeric, is widely available in a concentrated form. Now, that works well for inflammation, but it doesn't have all the other attributes of turmeric, plus it's more expensive. So you could consider that as a possibility, but it's not going to give you the broad spectrum action. Let's talk about some major pain remedies. Feverfew is very well known for gaining attention these days in terms of dealing with acute pain. Feverfew is a very cold, bitter herb, again, maybe problematic in this condition, but if some people tolerate it well, it does work pretty well for pain, and the nice thing about it is that it's a potent herb, so the dose is low, and you're likely to get better compliance. Typical dose for chronic pain, the kinds of things we're talking about here, is just 2 to 3 grams a day, and you can begin with 120 to 25 milligrams a day and work your way up. It's a little tough on the tummy sometimes. Kava is a wonderful herb for fibromyalgia and its cousin, chronic fatigue. It has all the properties that we want. It has different active ingredients than the other things we talked about, so you want to do a trial to make sure that the person you're working with tolerates it well. But it's a warming remedy that relaxes the musculature, which is exactly the direction we want to go. It helps people sleep, so it's a wonderful opportunity. Kava is available in many forms. Typical dose would be about 250 milligrams of total kava lactones per day, but that's about one-tenth the dose that people consume in where kava is native, so we can go much higher if needed. Great herb to investigate. Kava traditionally is used as a tea, and that works very, very well. And I've been using kava for 25 years, way before the kava craze started, and I used to import kava from Vanuatu in burlap bags from some friends there and then just give it to people and say, cook it up for tea. The kava lactones in kava are not very water-soluble, so decocting isn't the greatest way to get out all the active ingredients, but I used it for 20 years that way. Tastes like, dishwater mixed with okra. It's not very wonderful tasting, but works very, very well. And frankly, I had good compliance with that because it was so effective that people were willing to deal with the taste and the mess. It's now available as tincture. There are a lot of concerns about how kava preparations are made, so you want to use a top-quality preparation. And if you're using tincture, you want to use a high-alcohol tincture that extracts the kava lactones well. What we're usually going to see is an extract of the kava lactones, which works quite well, actually, and is perfectly fine. That's mainly what is going to be seen to be available. A lot of attention these days with hops, and we're finding out that hops have a property that we hadn't really known about before, hadn't concentrated on, and that's this material that's now being called perluxan by the manufacturer. So this is a concentration of the alpha acids in hops, and it turns out that a supercritical extract of these alpha acids is quite effective at relieving pain. So perluxan isn't the trade name or the brand name of a particular product. It's a proprietary name of this extract, and then companies like we see in the slide here, Swanson uses that to make their particular proprietary product. So these alpha acids are anti-inflammatory, and they're equivalent in the scientific literature to other NSAIDs like ibuprofen. It compares quite favorably to ibuprofen. A gram of perlexan equal to about 400 milligrams of ibuprofen, which is two typical tablets, and it works very well in the gut, inhibits all these pro-inflammatory substances in the body. Another suggestion from Ayurveda, this is a very much a typical workhorse Ayurveda formula, Abhipatakara Churna. Churna just means powder. The formula is Abhipatakara. In my most recent book, I called this the Rolades of Ayurveda. This is the digestive formula that you take when you ate four times your normal amount of food at Thanksgiving dinner and you feel like you have a bowling ball in your stomach. So it contains mild carminatives that gently increase the digestive power, the Agni, as Ayurvedists would say, and that helps to lower the overall cold, dry nature of vata, which is what fibromyalgia is all about. These are the ingredients. You can look at that at your convenience, but basically we see a bunch of mildly warming carminatives. And then the one ingredient that's a little unusual here is this nishruta root, you can see, or operculina, that is an herb that you don't see in just about any other formula any other time. This is kind of its signature formula. That nishrota is a laxative remedy. So realize that this formula is limited by the amount of laxative that you can use. So 3 to 5 grams twice a day would be a typical digestive enhancing dose. This Nishrota is also known as Trivit, which is the name by which I learned it. It's in the morning quarry family, and it provides a modest, moderate laxative kind of effect when you're looking to detoxify the digestive tract and enhance the warmth of digestion. Fundamentally, fibromyalgia is a dose of low vitality. It's really a total system crash of the entire neurology and endocrine system of the body, called the low ojas disease in Ayurveda, which equals high vata that we've mentioned, a disease of pain hypersensitivity. People with this fibromyalgia condition have responses to pain that are 2, 3, 4 times that of an average healthy person. So it is a cold, dry disease, therefore it's more likely to happen to cold, dry people, and it's a disease of aging. It's really just an exaggerated version of vata aging. All the symptoms really are things that people in the extreme of dysfunctional aging experience. Most people with fibromyalgia have had a triggering event of some kind that started their whole fall over the cliff, an auto accident, a serious viral disease, an emotional shock, something like that. So your basic treatment strategy for fibromyalgia is going to be warmth, diet, and rest, with an emphasis on the rest. Really, it requires a total lifestyle makeover. There's no magic bullet for fibromyalgia. It has to be a full-blown approach. But I've seen people, I just saw someone yesterday who has had this disease for 20 years, and she's getting better now. We've been treating her for about 5 months, and she just told me that the last month that she had was the best month she's had in 15 years. So we know that we can make very, very good progress. People with this condition always are highly toxic, but they're also highly debilitated. So we have to do rebuilding and we have to do detoxification. Generally speaking, we want to detoxify before we rebuild, but of course these people are already not very robust. So you're probably going to have to do a little detox, a little rebuilding, a little detox, and work your way through that situation in the individual case. So officially, this condition is widespread muscular pain and fatigue. That's what identifies it. The diagnostic standard for fibromyalgia reads like a Chinese restaurant menu. It's a long, long, long list of symptoms, and the diagnosis is literally pick from this list, and if you have a certain amount of these symptoms, you can qualify to have the official diagnosis. So this is a syndromic diagnosis. These are the kinds of things that we typically see in fibromyalgia, this very large constellation. Deep aching, muscular sensation, burning, stabbing pain, throbbing, all these neuro kinds of symptoms, and especially with training fatigue and muscular weakness, that really characterizes it. All three of these diseases are exactly the same thing. They're different names for the same condition, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, and in Europe it's usually called myalgic encephalopathy. It's all the same syndrome, and we should treat it the same. Whether the person's diagnosis is CFIDS or fibromyalgia, same basic procedure for treatment. 70% of fibromyalgia patients can be diagnosed as having irritable bowel syndrome. It's a tremendous overlap with these other sort of mysterious diseases of endocrine collapse. In order to be diagnosed as having fibromyalgia, a person has to have a history of widespread pain, and they have to have tenderness of a specific definition at 11 of 18 defined points. These are not trigger points. These are tender points, and on digital palpation, they have to be painful, not just a little bit bothersome. These 18 points are essentially completely arbitrary, and we'll revisit that here in just a second. A syndrome, by definition, is a set of signs and symptoms that have overlap between a large patient group. In the case of fibromyalgia, the list of symptoms is so long that it's very possible for two people
KP, are you there? KP. Hi, I don't know if you guys can hear me. I'm not hearing KP, and I don't know what's happened to the sound. I don't know if KP, if you can hear me, but we've lost your audio for some reason. And so check your mic and see if there's a problem with it or something. And
hello, Stephen.
Hi. We lost sound there for a second.
All right. What I was telling you was that I didn't have slide advancement.
Oh, okay.
It was advancing perfectly there.
Yeah, I think what happened was is that there must have been a glitch in your internet connection that just dropped out for a minute, and then it's back. So you should advance now. There you go.
There you go. Okay.
Okay.
3 to 6 million Americans, according to the government. Very, very common disorder. All right, we got one slide to advance. That was progress.
Okay, KP.
Same issue, not advancing.
Yeah, sounds like you drop out again here. I can advance it for you, I think. There you go.
Okay. That little blue arrow at the bottom, do I have access to that or only you?
Yes, you do. You should have access to it.
Okay. All right. So somewhere around 2% of the population, Dr. Weil and many other sources say that it's about more like 5%. In a general medical practice, it accounts for 5% of patients. So you can tell that it's a very, very common problem. Here's some prevalence statistics, anywhere from 1 to 20% in a rheumatology clinic, as you would expect, 1 out of 5, but it's incredibly common. I'll let you look at these things again and get the detail at your convenience. Interestingly, we have a lot more fibromyalgia than any other part of the world. It's about 1% in Britain and Scandinavia, which I think you would agree have similar climate, latitude, socioeconomic standards, even maybe ethnic mix, but less than half of the rate here. It's a woman's disease, 10 times more frequent in women than men. 30% of total rheumatology consultations. This is a big, big concern. A 10-year average gap between onset and diagnosis, which means a very, very frustrating 10 years for people. We take a little bit of a look at how this whole thing developed. We go back to the mid-70s when the word actually began to be used. Mid-1980s, everybody agreed on what the diagnostic standard would be, so people started talking about this as a distinct disease identity. By 87, the word saw its first appearance in a medical journal, and by 1992, there was an insurance code issued for it by WHO, and it showed up in the diagnostic manual. So we're looking at about 20 years of official development and history of this disease since it was recognized and could be covered by insurance. Typical kinds of areas of pain in fibromyalgia, neck, shoulder, and hip, but also includes things like menstrual cramps, TMJ, chest pain, and headache. Any part of the body can be an issue. About 90% of people have some kind of sleep disturbance, and from my perspective, that's the key issue here is sleep concerns, restless legs, irritable bladder, all kinds of jerky muscles, fibro fog, so-called confusion, concentration difficulties, which many people say are worse than the pain. So the percentage of people who have these kinds of things, but you can see how wide-ranging it is, everything from anxiety to mouth dryness to urinary urgency to Raynaud's phenomenon are characterized the disease. The number one key point in diagnosis is fatigue not resolved by resting. That's actually more of a diagnostic factor and experienced by more people than pain, even though the name of the disease means pain. Let's talk a little bit about the sleep issue then. The kind of sleep that's involved in fibromyalgia is sleep that's not refreshing. So people they either can't fall asleep, stay asleep, or they wake up early, but one way or another they wake up, they're not refreshed from their sleep. They're exhausted, yet they have insomnia, which we're not supposed to be wired that way. It's really typical that people wake up exactly at 3 a.m. That seems kind of mysterious, except for you Ayurveda and TCM practitioners, you know that that's the time when this kind of energy manifests in the body. It's the height of the Vata hour from the point of view of Ayurveda. Normal sleep cycles include delta and deep delta sleep, which is the time your body does its final detoxification and healing of the tissues. So when people have the absence of this delta stage, they have a reduction in the healing hormones that give them that final detoxification and healing of the muscles during the night when the muscles go completely limp. Various musculoskeletal symptoms, including things like restless legs to stiffness and joint aching. The list is incredibly long. Neurological symptoms, even more important. Let me just say, by way of introducing this, and then we'll revisit this idea, fibromyalgia is not a disease of the musculoskeletal system. It's a neurological disorder manifesting as muscle pain in most people. So if you think of it as a hormonal and neurological disease, you'll be much further ahead. Chronic headaches, including migraines, TMJ problems, tingling kinds of issues, dizziness, all neurological symptoms, a very serious immune components, so people eventually develop sensitivities to everything in their life, chemicals, food, weather changes, and they develop chronic flu-like symptoms. So people have some serious viral episode as the triggering episode, and it never goes away. They're not sitting around vomiting every day like having the flu, but it's like having a mild case of the flu 24 hours a day for the rest of your life. Skin changes. Very characteristic, color and sensitivity. Digestive issues, we talked about the IBS. The main point in fibromyalgia is gas. We know that, again, a Vata disease, gas is the hallmark of Vata. But alternating constipation and diarrhea, very common, and a diagnosis of irritable bowel is 70% overlap. Urinary symptoms, bladder pain, urinary frequency, strong connection with interstitial cystitis. There's a huge overlap there. Pain in the sex organs, painful intercourse. Cognitive functions, this fibro fog is a major factor for people. I can't tell you how many people have said, I can deal with some pain, but going back into the living room five times to try to find my car keys and forgetting why I'm there is really ruining my life. And, of course, the emotional component is very strong here. People are prone to anxiety and depression, but is that part of the disease or the effect of having been sick for so long with the disease that has no medical cure? There's an area of fibromyalgia treatment called associated conditions, and it's a huge list of things that happen to people that nobody can agree, are they things that go along with it, are they part of the syndrome, or are they things that the same kind of people tend to develop? Another word that's sometimes used is concomitant symptoms, so associated, comorbid, or part of the syndrome, they end up being all the same things, but they may just be reflections of the underlying factors that are involved in this disease in the first place. In other words, cold, dry people get all these kinds of things. But, you know, here's the beginning of the list, and the list just goes on for pages. So I'll let you look at these at your convenience when we post this. More and more and more: menstrual cramps, yeast overgrowth, interstitial cystitis. How many of these are cause? How many are effect? How many kind of go along for the ride? Challenging to know. So who gets fibromyalgia? Well, from the conventional medicine perspective, it's a 40-year-old female with a history of insomnia and some kind of a recent traumatic episode like a car crash, or I'm treating someone now who the whole thing began when she walked into her daughter's, her teenage daughter's bedroom and found her daughter on the floor having a grand mal epileptic seizure, and within a week she manifested fibromyalgia symptoms and just went down the spiral. Ayurveda would characterize this as a person of vata constitution that's dry and thin, or their frame is thin. They're not necessarily underweight now, and in fact they're usually overweight because they've been on the couch for 5 years, lifetime of constipation. In general, alternative medicine sees some kind of alternative underlying pathology, such as a chronic virus. The immune system is a major focus, and these people often have been caretakers. So we have this whole generation now of prime fibromyalgia candidates, older middle-aged women taking care of their aging, ill parents. We're just set for an avalanche of this disorder, which has been increasing every year. So cause-wise, my focus is on sleep disorders, and my entire approach to fibromyalgia is about getting people to sleep. And I suggest to people that they literally move to Tahiti, live there for a year, sleep in a hammock, swim in the surf, and eat tropical healthy food for a year. And I'm not kidding. Most people won't do that, can't do that. In fact, I can't think of anyone who's ever done that. But at the least, it gives people the idea of the seriousness of having to sleep. Many other ideas about cause, from physical trauma to hyperventilation dysfunctions and HIV infections and steroid withdrawal, and goes on and on for things that cause or begin this disorder. I'd like to refer you to the work of Jacob Teitelbaum, who's a personal friend of mine, and I really like his work, and I would say that his work resonates the most with mine. He himself made this his specialty because he had chronic fatigue / fibromyalgia syndrome. He's written a couple of very good books recently, Pain-Free 1-2-3, and From Fatigue to Fantastic. So when we met, it was like two brothers meeting. We just said, you do this? Yeah, you do that. This is what works, right? So we all found, we both found the same thing. This is my book, Fibromyalgia Text. So Teitelbaum discovered through his research and being a clinician that there were cellular energy difficulties at the basis of this entire thing, and that the hypothalamus, is his big thing is the hypothalamus, that its function gets disrupted, and that the hypothalamus acts essentially as a circuit breaker for the body's stress. When the complete stress level rises to a certain place, the hypothalamus literally blows a fuse. Energy stores are depleted, and he likes to address the hypothalamus very early. However true that metaphor happens to be, it's a good way to understand what's going on, and as your endocrine system crashes and acts like a symphony without a conductor, it ends up in these sleep disorders, low body temperature, hormone dysfunctions, that kind of thing. So his explanation for the muscles hurt is that because they're unable to produce adequate energy in their metabolism, they shorten and that then become painful. That causes loss of sleep because of the pain. That causes the muscles to not be able to heal, and we just go round and round with that muscle shortening, lack of detoxification issue. So ultimately, you want to restore adequate energy production and get rid of these other things that stress the body, such as infection. And ultimately, the hypothalamus comes back online, releases the muscles, and resolves the muscular pain. So Teitelbaum was involved in a placebo-controlled study here recently where they, in the study, they applied his particular paradigm, the holistic overall perspective, got improvement in 91% of the patients with an average 90% of quality of life improvement. That's pretty drastic. After 3 months on his protocol, which wouldn't be unusual to any of you. It's a good diet, you know, supporting the endocrine system, dealing with their pain situation. the majority no longer met the diagnostic criteria for fibromyalgia. So that's how rapid it can be. Now, the longer a person has had this problem, the more challenging it's going to be. So diagnosis is a huge, snarly mess, but we'll take a little bit of a look here. So this is the official definition from the American College of Rheumatology from 20 years ago. You have to have a history of greater than 3 months of widespread pain. It has to be in two of the four body quadrants. So it has to be on the left and the right side, above and below the waist, and has to involve the axial skeleton. So if you have horrible fibromyalgia from the waist up, sorry, doesn't qualify. And it has to be pain, not just irritation or tenderness, on 11 of these 18 arbitrary tender points. Not trigger points, but tender points. If you have 10 of these specific 18, you can't be diagnosed. You might have 99 other tender points in other places, but you still can't get the diagnosis. It's just really it's hard to understand where we are with this thing. So no laboratory signs from fibromyalgia. These are the 18 trigger points. Digital pressure of about 9 pounds, and it's just enough to make your thumbnail blanch when you push. It's really not pushing very hard. So one of our close colleagues in the AHG, Chinchal Cabrera, also wrote a very good book on fibromyalgia, and this is what she said fibromyalgia feels like. So tender points are not a great way to monitor progress or diagnosis in fibromyalgia. The count varies, the intensity varies day to day, but statistically, the amount of trigger point pain is a pretty good predictor for limitation of function. So not a perfect correlation, but at least it gives you some sense of progress. People that have less than 11 of the 18 might still qualify for the diagnosis of chronic pain syndrome and still have severe functional limitations. So the difference between fibromyalgia and chronic pain syndrome, just an arbitrary diagnostic difference based on this consensus of what the diagnosis should be. Arthritis Foundation says that it's not going to be curable, so you should understand and manage it. You want to work on relaxation, emphasize exercise, and then use drugs to treat the pain and improve sleep, which is a great idea if they actually worked. But in my experience, the actual fibromyalgia themselves are not very enthusiastic about the results they get from antidepressants or other drugs like benzodiazepines. Natural remedies typically work much, much better. So ultimately, pain is the elephant in the room here, but we don't want to ignore other things like cognitive difficulties and depression and the person's quality of life. It's important, as I said, to do this differential diagnosis properly because there are many other things that have overlapping symptoms. Mitral valve prolapse or multiple chemical sensitivity can look a lot like chronic fatigue fibromyalgia. So you have to do a very thorough assessment and really figure out what's going on with these things. Fortunately, we don't care about the name of this disease. Myofascial pain syndrome, which is the one that involves trigger points, has a 50% overlap with fibromyalgia, and fibromyalgia has a 20% overlap with myofascial pain syndrome. So they may be sort of a version of the same thing. Tremendous overlap with PTSD. Israel is a nation with one of the highest rates of PTSD in the world and one of the highest rates of fibromyalgia in the world. So huge statistical overlap between chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, and depression. I'll let you look at those statistics when you download this PowerPoint. Again, I'm just going to give you this information that you can download about the different characteristics of these two disorders. The mainstream perspective is to help people improve their functioning with no understanding of treating the disorder. Our perspective is that we want the person to get well and resume a healthy life. It's completely curable in my experience. I've never seen anyone who was not able to unravel this whole snarly mess and get their life back. Very doable. But it requires this overall body holistic perspective. So how can we bring our resources to bear? One of the main things to remember is that hurting doesn't mean not to move, and that's really challenging for people. Their whole day is spent on the couch, and their project for the day is to get up and go to the bathroom or go to the kitchen and make a sandwich. So moving hurts. They don't want to move. But every study on this has shown that the more people can move, the better they do in the long run. a good long deep sleep is the absolute number one treatment for this condition, and that's what I'm going to suggest treating. Because this is a Vata disease, you Ayurvedic folks will recognize that oily kinds of therapies in the diet, massage therapy, enema, are all going to be of benefit. So on a day-to-day basis dealing with these people, you should expect to have relapses. As people begin to feel better, they want to go out and spend that tiny little extra energy that they've regained, and they go and work a half an hour in the garden, and they're down for the next 4 days. And it's really hard to get people to understand this. And I now have just come to the conclusion that ongoing mini relapses are part of just what you deal with this whole situation. So I call my approach to fibromyalgia the Thrive approach, and these are the things that that are involved. I want to talk first about sleep, because that's the most important from my perspective. Every night, long, deep sleep. I'll just do anything to get these people out. These people just need to be knocked flat. They need to be down for the night. If we can get 16 hours of sleep, I'm happy. 12 hours of sleep would be great, but people need to bank sleep. Even if they say, look, I don't feel great, but I can function on 6 or 7 hours or 8 hours, fine, then bank the other four. Sleep, sleep, sleep. That's what heals this condition. Theanine is Teitelbaum's favorite natural remedy, and he said that it revolutionized his practice. I wouldn't go that far, but it's definitely one of the top remedies that I would recommend investigating. Melatonin, sublingual or sustained release versions, often using the two together is a great combination, because you can get an immediate effect from the sublingual, and then the sustained release kicks in over time, and that alone will generate 8, 10, maybe 12 hours of sleep with the proper program. 5-HTP, a metabolite of tryptophan, a serotonin precursor, taken at bedtime. The duration is relatively short, but in many people it's quite effective. Tryptophan itself is about 1/10 the potency of its metabolite, and so using higher doses of 500 to 2,000 milligrams right at bedtime to knock people out often works very, very well from the herbal side. A Chinese herb that might be familiar to some of you, this is the vine of the very famous Heshuwu herb, same plant, Polygonum multiflorum, but we're going to be using the vine, 15 grams at bedtime as tea. Very, very nice. It's a real workhorse sedative. This is what it looks like. Workhorse sedative from TCM. Nutmeg, an herb that takes a little bit of experience to learn how to use. It has about a four-hour delay from the time you take it to the time it's effective, but you get about 8 hours of sedation from it. So you can use nutmeg with another short-acting sedative, let's say poppy seed, administer the opiate at bedtime, take the nutmeg at bedtime. The poppy seed kicks in. 4 hours later, the nutmeg kicks in, and you have an automatic 12-hour window of knocked flat sleep. It's a great, great addition. Touch is a part of the Thrive approach. I just want to say that I'm a licensed massage therapist, and I'm very supportive of body work. When I wrote my book, I interviewed dozens and dozens of patients. Massage was the one that they mentioned the most as being beneficial, but the effect is transient and short. So most people find that they have to have massage at least twice a week to get any kind of consistency. People usually feel maybe slightly beat up after they get the massage. Maybe they feel a little better. They go home and take a hot Epsom salts bath, slide into bed. They feel better that day, maybe the next day, but by the next day their symptoms are all returning. So if money is no object and you have the time available to do it, having body work every other day is a great choice, but it's not a cure. It does help the muscle hypoxia, so it's a temporary symptomatic benefit. That doesn't make it wrong. It just means that it's an expensive way to go. Biofeedback, definitely worth considering. Some really nice studies in the literature on biofeedback for fibromyalgia. Dealing with the immune system, critical. if a person, if there's a viral component to a person's particular fibromyalgia, then we have to get rid of that chronic virus if we're not going to make progress. But even so, the immune system becomes debilitated by having this endocrine crash, and people develop opportunistic infections that then slow their recovery. So we have to treat the kinds of things that have overwhelmed their body, including things like yeast and fungus. So I encourage you to treat existing chronic and acute infections. Because of this history, many people have taken antibiotics 10, 20, 30, 40 times, and they have tremendous gut dysbiosis. So you have to assess that and deal with that situation. If they have a body full of yeast, that you're not going to make progress. So chronic lung infections, a bowel, even things like toenail fungus, are you need to take that burden off the immune system. So a lot of sort of tangential things you need to do to pull things together. You herd the cats, you get on the right track, and slowly but surely you make progress, and then the progress can accelerate and do very, very well. In terms of ultimately reducing the chronic immune burden, we're going to use slow-acting immune enhancers, things like bowel probiotics, and you might even want to consider a trial of antifungal therapy, perhaps nystatin, ketoconazole, if you have access to those kinds of things. Usually we don't have to resort to those things, but sometimes you just need a hammer to really knock the invaders back so the immune system can get some breathing room and begin to conquer. Vitamins and nutrition is part of the Thrive approach. Ultimately, these people always are nutritionally bankrupt, and so that's part of why they got the disorder to begin with, but they often have multiple deficiencies, so you need to assess that by whatever method you use, whether it's blood tests or whatever it is, and then provide this broad support. One way to do that might be by using a megapotency multiple vitamin. Vitamin D is certainly the darling of nutritional therapy now, and I'm a great proponent of vitamin D, and there's some evidence that at least in some cases, fibromyalgia may be literally nothing but a vitamin D deficiency, and I've treated maybe 4 or 5 cases in total now. It's relatively rare, but situations where people had full-blown diagnosed fibromyalgia, we brought their blood level of vitamin D to repletion, which is about 75 to 85 nanograms per milliliter, and their symptoms disappeared, and they no longer qualified as having the disease, and voila, fibromyalgia cured. That's rare, but you should be open to that. So if I were going to go to a desert island and I could only have one therapy for fibromyalgia, well, I'm going to take two, vitamin D and magnesium. So a lot of good rationale for why vitamin D would be involved in this whole scenario. My second favorite remedy would be magnesium. This is just the core of fibromyalgia treatment. And since the vast majority of Americans have magnesium deficiency, it's the most common nutritional deficiency after vitamin D. You can assume that your clients have it. You're not going to hurt them by using high doses of oral magnesium. And again, we've seen a few cases where magnesium by itself essentially cured fibromyalgia. So I encourage you to investigate it. 350 biochemical reactions involving energy production and many other things connected with magnesium. So really important to be aware of that. 95% of our population is deficient, according to the literature. Wow. So magnesium is highly anti-inflammatory. Again, fibromyalgia is not an inflammatory disorder, but if there is inflammation involved in the overall global situation of a person's body, magnesium is a good choice there. You can use just about any form of magnesium. They all tend to work pretty well. They all have the same disadvantage, and that's loose stool. Magnesium oxide is in the far end of producing the most loose stool. It still works, but the dose is very suppressed because of the using this particular type of magnesium, so I don't recommend it. The current leader in terms of producing the least loose stool is magnesium glycinate, which is a new player, relatively recent, not that available. Most health food stores would probably have it by now. You could sniff it out, and most people will get an increase of 40 to 60% in their total dose before they get to bowel tolerance with magnesium glycinate compared to other forms of magnesium, so it's well worth investigating. About 1,200 milligrams is a typical magnesium dose. Ribose is a relatively new player on the scene. It's a sugar that our bodies produce naturally. It's not in foods. Our bodies produce it in our cells. All living cells have it, but it's the carbohydrate source of our cells' ability to produce energy molecules, ATP. Teitelbaum, again, was the senior author on a very recent ribose study that was very impressive. It was an initial study with 41 patients that corresponded to the fibromyalgia population at large. They were matched. They used 5 grams a day, 5 grams three times a day for an average of a month. And after 12 days, two-thirds of them had significant improvement in energy, sleep, pain, well-being, 44% increased energy, 30% increased well-being, and overall a 25% improvement in quality of life after 12 days. That's pretty pretty remarkable. That's just an astounding result. So for the average healthy person, our bodies use about 5 grams a day of ribose. Fibromyalgia, more like 20 grams might be necessary. So Teitelbaum likes to start with 5 grams a day and then titrate the dose up by 3 to 5 grams a day until you get to the level where the person is having the best subjective experience. This isn't a slam dunk for everyone, but for the people who find it to be beneficial, often it's very dramatic. 2 weeks with ribose and they're a new person. Their disease isn't cured, but they're doing a lot better. Tyrosine, an amino acid that the body uses to create excitatory neurotransmitters and thyroid hormone, used early in the day, 500 to 3,000 milligrams typical dose. Phenylalanine is another closely related amino acid that the body can use to convert to the same thing. So here's the way it goes. Phenylalanine becomes tyrosine, converted through DOPA, dopamine, and eventually to norepinephrine, an excitatory neurotransmitter, and then eventually epinephrine, which you know is adrenaline. Tyrosine is also the backbone for thyroid hormones, so you get a twofer there, all of which increases energy. This doesn't cure fibromyalgia, but it helps people feel better temporarily. Exercise, critical. Very difficult to accomplish with most people. Every study tells us that activity is important to people's recovery, but the exercise has to be very individualized and very well paced to not have boom or bust cycles. So maybe getting a physical therapist or occupational therapist involved is a good idea. We don't want people having relapses, so I tell people to exercise to half their capacity, what they think their capacity would be. So if they think they could walk to the mailbox and back, walk halfway to the mailbox and back. If everything went fine, the next day walk three-quarters of the way to the mailbox, but stay under the presumed capacity. Nobody ever does that, but that's what I suggest. So people have these mini relapses, and after 20 mini relapses, they learn. So tonic herbs ultimately are the answer to rebuilding this whole scenario, and here's a nice long list of them. These are all from Ayurveda, but there are similar kinds of herbs that we know from other systems for a broad-based stamina-enhancing endocrine regulation. Ashwagandha, a great example of one of those tonic herbs. Astragalus, similar idea. Astragalus and TCM is really not known so much as an immune herb, as we characterize it here, but sort of a junior tonic, kind of a junior ginseng amla from Ayurveda. So some examples of these ideas. Here's a great example from TCM of a tonic soup, including these half a dozen slow-acting long-term stamina enhancers, and this makes a tasty soup, and it's worth, worth giving a try for people. Ayurveda has a bunch of these herbal jellies that are made into kind of a sweet paste, and they all have tonifying kinds of effects. Chyawanprash, pictured here, is the most well-known one, but they also might be called by these other names you see on your screen, Avaleha Gulam or Leham. These are all gooey, soft, heavy preparations that help to support long-term healing. Chyawanprash, especially for immune support, and it's highly anti-inflammatory. Here's just another one, Leham made from ashwagandha. There are many, many hundreds of these. I just wanted to draw your attention to these if you are not familiar with them. No slide advancing. Stephen, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
No slide advancing. Can you advance that one? Just another example.
Okay.
Advance. Here's the ingredients from that. You can take a look at this at your convenience. These are all variations of similar kinds of things. You can see on this list a bunch of familiar herbs. Another example. So I'll let you take a look at these. But these are anti-aging, long-term, stamina-enhancing remedies. Here's the herb gota cola, made into a medicated ghee for the nervous system. So a building foundational kind of remedy. Well worth looking into these kinds of Ayurvedic semi-soft liquid kinds of preparation. Just some other examples that we found to work well. I can thank Michael Tierra for directing my attention to this herb, Chinese teasel. The scientific name is Dipsacus. This is a real workhorse remedy in Chinese medicine for treating the musculoskeletal system. It's said to knit the sinews. It's used for fractures and bruises and sprains and strains. And so it's a Chinese species of, we have teasel plants in North America. It's the root of that. So I call that the arnica of Chinese medicine. It's used for the similar kinds of ideas, broad application for musculoskeletal things, but very good for muscular healing in general and works very well in fibromyalgia, kind of very neutral energetics, very well tolerated by a wide variety of people. Half an ounce of herb as powder or tea is a great choice. This is what it's going to look like at the Chinese herb store, Dipsacus root. Next routine is another one of those proprietary extracts that's used to make products. It's an extract of philodendron or amur cork tree bark. And mainly it's probably anti-inflammatory. Amur cork tree bark contains berberine. Maybe it's just from the berberine, but it's looking pretty good as a possibility for treating pain. Inhibits these inflammatory enzymes. Here's the tree. About the size of an oak tree, the tree from which the bark has been harvested. So what it's going to look like in the Chinese herb store. This is a very, very well-known herb, huangbai. Sometimes comes sliced. The yellow is from the berberine. So Chinese herb store, you're going to see these various preparations of this product. So this next routine, a few initial studies, faster analgesic onset than naproxen. Here was one trial with almost 400 people. 91% had beneficial effects in reduction of pain and increased mobility and flexibility. So that sounds pretty good. A list of blood movers like we talked about at the beginning. These are all from TCM. I would encourage you to investigate these and add these to your bag of tricks. I'll let you download this list later. Here's one that probably will be new to most people. This is an umbellifer, Chamdonggui, a Korean remedy, the common name, Korean giant angelica. It's a close relative of Donghui. It's a multipurpose blood mover, but it contains higher amounts of the active ingredients in Donghui, dicursinol and dicursin. And just one initial study showed 70% of the people that received the dicursinol from the Chamdonggui had significant improvement in their scores for pain and dysfunction after only 4 days. So nice to know about. This herb probably is not going to be very available as a whole herb, but the dicursinol extract made from the Chamdonggui is available as an ingredient, and companies are beginning to include it in their products, so you could be aware of that. Arnica tincture taken internally, very effective, very likely to work well. It's much less toxic than people often think. It's used internally, absolutely, but you want to be very, very careful with this because this is an herb that could kill you. You need to know how to use it. Don't go beyond your limits. Learn about it. 1 to 10 tincture in a typical dose is up to about 100 drops. You want to titrate that dose very carefully. And if you get to the point of having warmth in the GI tract, any kind of heart arrhythmia or kind of a stimulating nervous feeling, you're way too far. I've never had to go that high. I've never even seen these side effects. We got the positive effects before we got to that dangerous place. This arnica would not be suitable because it's made with a type of alcohol that's not drinkable. So you want to make sure that it's proper for external, for internal use. How about some things to apply externally? Mineral bath therapy is one of the most successful things for fibromyalgia in the literature. There are many, many studies showing that bathing in these warm mineral springs produces as much relief as just about anything out there. So improvement in a wide variety of variables that's very long-lasting. So it's worth looking into if you have access to this sort of thing. Castor oil for your Ayurvedas, we know that this is the leading topical preparation to treat vata. So the vata disorder, nervous diseases, things. So to control that instability, that wind in the nervous system, castor oil massage externally, the ultimate overall treatment for this sort of situation. I was involved in a study with a fibromyalgia support group, and we tested about 10 topical products and just gathered data on them to determine what would work well. And much to our surprise, menthol products came out best in the study. Menthol is anti-inflammatory, and fibromyalgia is not inflammatory, but we discovered that using a small blob of a menthol ointment on a tender point as a spot treatment was the most effective. Using it for overall body massage was too cooling for people, but that came out of the top of the study. Capsaicin cream, blocking the substance P as it enters the nervous system, very, very good, one of my current favorites. It's not, does not work by being heating. This isn't a counter-irritant. It works by blocking substance P. But what I meant by being cautious of it, that it's hot, is don't get it in your eye or other special places. So be hot if you put it in those places. It blocks pain. It's not about the heat. So a pea-sized amount to the affected joint. You don't want to do full body massage with cayenne ointment. St. John's wort oil, I just put on the list here because I think you'd like to have this in your bag of tricks. It's not one of my favorites. It's not a heavy hitter, but it's safe, and you can use it for full body massage, and it's generally beneficial for chronic pain. Plus, it's a nerve restorative. So a great herb to think about. It's hard to get quality St. John's wort oil preparations in America. Here we're talking about arnica externally, a use that many of us are already familiar. This is the Herb Farm arnica tincture. Vitality Works also makes one that I like a lot. Those two are kind of my main go-to remedies there. And I use arnica tincture as a liniment externally. You get maximum arnica benefit. It penetrates completely. The alcohol evaporates. And we're talking about herbal arnica here, not the homeopathic arnica. So a little discussion of hormones before we wrap up and have questions here. Hormonal dysfunction is very much a part of fibromyalgia, and it's critical that we understand what's going on hormonally. So I suggest that you just give this your attention, assess the status of hormones by any means that you have, whether it's blood tests or various other specialized tests. Maybe it's just symptom assessment, and then apply bioidentical hormones as needed. So you might consider low-dose cortisol from prescription sources or some kind of a natural equivalent like this Bezuecan product. Thyroid. Hypothyroid is completely overlapping with fibromyalgia. It's a chicken or the egg. So a trial of Armour thyroid, natural source thyroid, from somewhere from a half to 3 grains a day, the subjectively best dose, is a great thing to be aware of. Testosterone sometimes has some benefit. Testosterone is prescription, so you're going to have to get access to that in some way, but a transdermal or sublingual kind of preparation of testosterone. Okay, so we're at the end of the official slides here. Stephen would like to say a word about the American Herbalist Guild, and then we'll have a little bit of time for some questions. So on your webinar console, you have a question box, so please type your question in there, and then Stephen, you'll have to instruct me about how to read these questions, and we'll go through those that we can.
So actually, I'll have to read them to you because they only show up on my screen. So
very good.
This webinar, of course, has been brought to you by the American Herbalist Guild, and we're going to do three more free educational webinars this year. And then next year, for our members, we're going to do 6 of these educational webinars that will be available only to our members. So if you're interested becoming a member of the American Herbalist Guild, there's the contact information for the AHG. You can become a general member for just $60, and you get the journal to the American Herbalist Guild twice a year, There's a online access to a lot of back issues and recordings from previous AHG conferences and webinars, and a lot of other benefits that come with learning about herbs and getting some great training. So let's go ahead and look at some of the questions that have already been asked, and I'll find them here. Someone says, I believe that fluoride and toxins that come with it, such as mercury, arsenic, and lead, are a large part of my pain. How do I safely detox fluoride and other toxins without stripping good nutrients? And what do you think of injectable magnesium, as fibromyalgia people have low magnesium levels in their cells?
Just for the sake of time, I'm going to answer the second question. I've seen remarkable results with IV magnesium. Just for the sake of time, I didn't include it in the preparation, but it truly is a limp-in, leap-out kind of scenario. By injecting magnesium IV, you can bump the blood levels up much more effectively than oral doses. You bypass that whole bowel tolerance issue, and you get spectacular results. Yale University did a study that came out about 6 months ago on IV magnesium, and they gave people a total of 10 IV infusions. I think they did two a week, something like that, but a grand total of 10. The results were spectacular. I was talking to Dr. Katz from Yale, who was the head of the study, and the guy was practically leaping through the phone in his excitement about this thing. It was the most dramatic thing he'd ever seen. And as I recall, they had 100% of their study population no longer qualifying for a diagnosis of fibromyalgia just after the magnesium IV. Now, the disadvantage, other than the time commitment, is that they're kind of expensive. They're only available from those that are licensed to administer them, so that would be medical doctors, naturopathic physicians. It's an IV push with a syringe, not a drip, so someone has to sit there and push on the syringe for 20 minutes, which, of course, 20 minutes of a nurse's time is expensive, so most practitioners charge about $100 per injection. So just the first 10 injections is going to be $1,000. In terms of effect per dollar, you could buy an off flood of ashwagandha and tyrosine for $1,000. So I love the idea. I've seen stupendous results with it. It really hikes the speed at which people get well. These magnesium IVs may be known under the rubric of Myers cocktail, M-Y-E-R-S. But that's essentially a magnesium IV with some other little doodads added. I'm very favorable toward that idea. Of course, that's not a natural method in the strictest sense. You can get there with oral magnesium. It just takes a lot longer because of the bowel tolerance issue. Next question.
Okay. What do you think of enemas as a form of bowel and liver cleansing?
I'm very favorable of using enemas for bowel cleansing. Enemas can be used for a wide range of things because from the Ayurvedic perspective, the home of Vata is the large intestine. Using enemas make great sense, especially oily enemas, to counteract the cold, dry nature of this disorder and to help facilitate proper nerve function in general. I think that you need to not overuse them, I guess is how I'm going to say that. So as a part of an integrated management program, they make great sense, and people now have to know what they're doing to use them. I think they're probably as often improperly used as properly used, but under the right circumstances, very much a part of a program.
I have milk intolerance, yet I want probiotics to reestablish gut flora. What do you suggest?
There are a number of companies that produce non-dairy probiotics, and they seem to work pretty well. You have to experiment a little bit with which one is going to work well for you. My current favorite these days is a probiotic called Bio-K, bio-dash, and then the letter K. It's in all health food stores now. And this is it comes in a little jar. I think maybe it's a 3-ounce jar, but it's a very small little jar. It's just a couple swallows. It tastes like super sour yogurt. I'm not sure that they have a non-dairy version, but they have two or three or four or five different versions. But it's a super-duper high-potency remedy. It's a little on the expensive side. Each of those little jars is a couple bucks, and you might use one to three a day for the first, let's say, 2 weeks to reestablish bowel flora. But that's the current superstar in my book, and I've been talking to students about it, and they've been coming back raving about it too. So it seems to be really a step forward in terms of reestablishing that proper gut flora. Let me say a word about gut flora for just a second. It's really misunderstood, this whole area, And it's a great boon to the manufacturers for you to take a quarter teaspoon of probiotic every day for the rest of your life, but that's not how probiotics work. These are like dueling armies in your gut, and when your gut is sterilized of good bacteria from antibiotics or acute diarrhea, somebody's going to live in there, and the bugs that come to recolonize tend to be bad bugs. So in order to recapture the territory in the gut wars, you have to put in a massive invasion of good bugs. So using very high doses, like 3 jars of the BioK a day for 2 weeks, is usually adequate. And then once they've established their beachhead and they've set up camp there, they're the new inhabitants, and then the other guys would have to kick them out, and they usually will then be fine there after that. We've shown this over and over with stool samples, and I'm very convinced that that's the way to go.
Have a comment here that says, the majority of clients and persons I've seen with this and other similar conditions come from high areas of chemical exposure, refineries, sprayed agricultural land, just a notable part of the history. And this person also says that many have had sexual abuse or compatible emotional levels of stress in the past.
Well, that, both of those things are absolutely true, and even the conventional literature on fibromyalgia acknowledges that a chemical exposure of any kind is a real high risk and shows up way disproportionately in the history of these people. People who were fine until their house was, and the exterminator came for the termites, or they got exposed to a natural gas leak, or some kind of petrochemical thing, and then they were never the same ever since. Sexual abuse certainly, but any kind of emotional trauma like that is likely to be the precipitating event that sort of sets the stage, and then something happens, an auto accident, another episode of abuse. I mentioned the woman viewing her daughter's epileptic seizure, and then it's, the hypothalamus blows, according to Teitelbaum, they're over the cliff, it's a downward spiral forever unless we help them reestablish their homeostasis and rebuild their health.
Okay. Let's see. Oh, I got that one. Okay. Can you give us advice on how to discern the difference between diagnosing Lyme's disease and fibromyalgia? There seem to be a lot of crossover symptoms.
Yeah, the symptoms are often very, very similar. And Lyme disease is one of the diseases, furthermore, that can be the precipitating event to create the diagnosis of fibromyalgia. So the only way to confirm that is with a medical test to test for the presence of the spirochete. And otherwise, because people often don't know when they got the tick bite, and they're not aware that they have it, so that's a medical test, and then you'll know.
Someone says, I have noticed major issues with candida overgrowth with fibromyalgia syndrome. What are your best herbal nutritional therapies for candida?
I completely agree with that. And I would say that as a category, there are two categories of remedies that are really outstanding for yeast. The first is berberine-containing herbs. Yeast are quite sensitive to berberine, and so that could be anything from amur cork tree bark that we just talked about, to coptis, to barberry. These berberine-containing herbs, and high doses over time consistently smashing away at the yeast while you rebuild the immune system. You have to rebuild the immune system, or if all you do is poison the yeast. That works well as an initial part of your therapy, but as soon as you stop, they come right back. So you use that as a way to give the immune system a breather while you rebuild it. The other one is high tannin herbs. Tannins bond to the yeast cell wall and open basically a one molecule size hole in the yeast. And so if you get enough of them in there and they grab onto it and tear it open, it kills the yeast. So high tannin herbs. One of the highest tannin herbs in the world is acacia bark. The tree that produces gum acacia, the bark of that tree is used in Asian medicine as a tannin source, and it's dramatic for killing yeast. The Ayurvedic name for that is babul, B-A-B-U-L, babul bark, and I know that Vedic herbs carries that product in capsules, so otherwise kind of difficult to find, but that's a really outstanding one. High tannin herbs otherwise in general are likely candidates, so black walnut, kind of the usual suspects.
Okay, the person says your presentation of what it's like to have this is dead on, almost cried, it's so validating. Would you consider making recording this available so patients can play it for their family, friends, employers? Developing understanding in our support groups is often the biggest challenge we face. This is being recorded and it will be posted to the AHG website, and everyone who registered tonight will be sent a link where you'll be able to actually download this as a Windows media file or an MP3 recording.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what our policy is on that. This is the first time we've been asked that, and this is the first time we're doing this. So I don't want to put my foot in my mouth here, but I guess I would say if you can download it as a file, we can't control what you do with it after it gets out there. And this was available to the general public, so I doubt there's going to be a problem.
Okay, my husband was just recently diagnosed as on antidepressants. What's the best place for me to start to help him? Oh, wow, that's kind of a general question. Obviously, I think you kind of made that clear, maybe that already. So,
yeah, let's move on. That's general and personal.
That's too general. Okay, this is a question someone watched tonight because they have fibro. They're not an herbalist. How do they find a qualified herbalist in their area? Well, if you go to the American Herbalist Guild website, you can actually search for professional members of the American Herbalist Guild, and that might be in your area.
That's exactly what I'm going to recommend. The link is at the upper left-hand side of the webpage. It's called Find an Herbalist. You click on it. There's a list of states. You click on your state or a neighboring state. It'll open up and tell you the people that are near you. If you have difficulty with that, you're welcome to call or email me, and you could get my contact information through the website of the American Herbalist Guild or call the office. I hope I'm not unleashing an avalanche of work for the office, but I would be glad to help you with that.
Okay. Someone says, you said several times curing fibromyalgia. Curing, do you mean no longer hit the 11 out of 18 points or returning back to the normal self of being able to function normally?
I mean returning back to the normal self. In my experience, for about 10 years, my practice was 90% fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue, and then I ended up writing a text about it. I've just seen hundreds of people with this disorder, and they're all able to get back to their normal level of functioning. Sometimes they're a little bit more fragile. That is, they don't have quite the reserve capacity. They were damaged in a way that they're never quite back to the way they were before, but their life is healthy and functional, and they can do everything they want. They may not be able to go out and party all night like they did before, but they can live their job, live their life, have their job, enjoy their families, and not have their chronic pain. I normally tell people to expect about a year to go from your average fibromyalgia case to the place of being basically back to being functional. Now, that's with decent compliance and due diligence, which, of course, people rarely do. So more like 2 years might be more reasonable, and the longer you've had it, the longer it takes to treat it. So someone who's been sick for – I'm treating someone now who was one of the first cases diagnosed in America. He's had it for 25 years, something like that, and that's going to be a longer haul, not because the fundamental underlying process is that hard to deal with, but because he's been so damaged in every other way from just being so sick for so long that every system of his body is damaged, and we just have to rebuild everything. I will say also that it's easy for me to tell you theoretically what works, and it's a complicated situation, but it's not that challenging to figure out your strategy. What's challenging is actually doing it and having the person really participate in the process and then have the resources that they need to have to get all this done. These are people who often are living their life on the couch watching old reruns of soap operas. They're financially bankrupt, emotionally bankrupt, all their family has left, all their support sources, they're living on government surplus cheese and Medicare. And they're just out of resources, and it's a tough go. So that's why I was saying that 90% of your concern with this disorder is non-therapeutic issues, like how do I get to my doctor's appointments and how do I afford to buy my meals at Whole Foods.
Yeah. In fact, several people have been asking about like the best way to get started and that sort of thing, which all is best handled by, you know, contacting and working with a professional herbalist or natural healer who's familiar with this. And we already suggested about checking on the AHG website. Someone said that they're 56 and were diagnosed with this when they were 14 years old, and they're on a number of meds. They want to know, should they discontinue their meds starting the herbs? So that's a really good question.
Yeah, great question to ask. The answer is no. Absolutely do not discontinue any medication unless told to do so by a licensed practitioner who prescribed the medication or who is qualified to assess it. And but beyond the legal answer, I don't recommend doing that anyway, because the main thing we want to look at here is smooth, steady, easy recovery. I didn't include this in the slide, but the Canadian government looked at this whole situation recently and said, this is a mess. We're not approaching this in an effective way. We're putting people on disability, but they never get well. What can we do to really give some guidance to this? And they came up with a policy that's guided by four S's. I don't have it in front of me, but it's slow, serene, smooth, and sensitive, something like that. But that should be your motto. No giant changes. Typically, if we could do this in connection with your prescriber, that would be fantastic. And that's not so likely to happen. But you want to cross-taper these things where you get going with your natural medicines, and as they begin to be effective and do their job and you bring the doses up, you begin to bring the doses of the pharmaceuticals down very, very carefully in proportion and do that cross taper in a very long, slow, smooth titration. It usually works very, very well. And, you know, I can't tell you to not take the medicine that was prescribed for you, but you're the owner of your own body and you can decide to do that if you like. And then if you're rheumatologist is, you know, your rheumatologist doesn't want you to be living on pain medication, antidepressants either. They just don't have anything else to suggest. So usually, you know, the saying, it's sometimes easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. So enough said about that.
Yeah. One person who apparently has this condition mentions that they don't know how they're going to get started improving their health because they can hardly get up enough energy to go make a pot of coffee. Do you have any suggestions of what to do to help people who are trying to like learn to eat right or whatever when they're so low in energy?
Yeah, I let me answer that in a second. I just calling your attention to the time. It's 5:37. Are we okay with our time for the webinar?
We're okay. We can go as
okay. So you know, a couple more minutes. We're officially over, but I don't mind continuing. Well, I really empathize with you, and I understand that's exactly the situation. And you know, for many of my clients over the years, their session with me was their project for the week, and it's just, you know, it's very, very challenging. A lot of this has to do really with public health policy, and what I would like to see is, you know, our government providing, rather than, you know, an endless supply of antidepressants for people on disability, provide some helpers who can come in and help people make some healthy food and help them get to their appointments and maybe hold their hand and say, here, let's walk out the door and walk to your mailbox and back for today's exercise. I think you could be, some of the things we talked about are quite safe. You could try a food elimination diet. That could be something. You have to eat something anyway, so you could experiment with that. You could use some very basic kinds of things like ashwagandha we talked about. That's not likely to harm anybody in any way. Unfortunately, it's a complicated situation, and really it's something that is going to be best handled by connecting with someone who can sort of put all the dots together. And, you know, it's an unsolvable problem, really. So, I would say just take heart, you know, keep your enthusiasm up, do whatever you can, and it may be a long, slow process, but at least you can make progress and you know that it is doable.
There are a number of questions that don't directly pertain to what we're talking about or are very personal questions about specific problems, which is something we really can't address on this, but I'm going to take two more questions here that I think are kind of general. One, someone asked to explain a little bit more about that shortened muscle fiber that you talked about, and about helping the hypothalamus.
Okay, well, that's a good question. when we sleep, we go into, for about an hour a night, the deepest level of sleep, which is called delta. And it's the only time in the 24 hours of your day when your muscles completely disconnect from your brain and you can't move. Your brain still may be active, but your muscles don't respond. You just lie there like a, you know, bowl of jelly. And that's the time when your muscles literally do turn to jello. There's no tension in them at all. The brain isn't telling them to contract, and that's the time when you get maximum blood and lymph flow through the muscles to carry away waste and bring nutrients to heal them. That's the time the body does its maximum deep healing. So when you don't descend into that delta sleep for that hour or so a night, your muscles don't detoxify and then heal and rebuild. So they're awash in their own waste material, which irritates them further and causes them to reflexively tighten, and then the next night the same problem. The tighter they get, the less chance your body has to bring blood in there and heal them, and it's an ever-escalating vicious circle. So Teitelbaum emphasized that in his understanding of fibromyalgia, and that's why I was telling you about it. But that's why sleep is absolutely so critical and why I want people to go to Tahiti and live in a hammock for 6 months. The hypothalamus is a little bit more speculative. That's Dr. Teitelbaum's metaphor for understanding what's happening here. And he conceptualizes the hypothalamus as literally a circuit breaker for the body. And it's a sort of a built-in fail-safe mechanism so your body doesn't destroy itself. So when the total cumulative list of stresses escalates to a certain place, the hypothalamus literally just shuts off and tells the body to go into a collapse shutdown mode so that you literally don't damage yourself. The idea being then that you'll go sleep and relax and recover, and then your hypothalamus will sort of click back in and you'll recover. In our culture, the problem is that we don't listen to that, and instead of sleeping for a year when we're sick, we continue to try to work and take care of our families and earn a living and do what we do, and these people just get sicker and sicker. So he doesn't have any great scientific evidence that the hypothalamus is really the thing. He's just deduced that from his experience. I'm not sure if it's literally true, but it's a great metaphor that your body has a sort of a stress switch that gets flipped and everything just goes into shutdown. And really, fibromyalgia is best understood as a sleep disorder that then causes a complete system crash where everything becomes dysregulated. Your endocrine system can't figure out what hormones to secrete when. Your brain doesn't know when to help you sleep and when not. You're sort of perpetually awake yet half asleep, and you get into all the cognitive dysfunction. Your digestive system malfunctions, and the whole thing is just completely wacky. The longer people exist in that state, the more long-term damage they get to their organs, and that's why we end up with this huge long list of symptoms. So hypothalamus, you know, that remains to be seen if that can be proven, but the idea is very clinically appropriate.
Okay. Actually, I found two questions I think that are appropriate. One is someone is asking about like Western herbs for pain management, like valerian, passionflower, catnip, lemon balm, and one of their favorites, wild lettuce. Or would any of these be helpful remedies? Or
Yeah, they're all helpful, and I think they're all great things to have in your bag of tricks. The reason I didn't mention them is just because they're all quite mild compared to the ones that I was recommending. So the amount of valerian that you need for, and valerian is the most potent of those ones that you mentioned, and you get into the passion flowers of the world, and you're talking very, very high doses that are just, compliance is the problem. Passion flower is a great relaxant for fibromyalgia, but it's just hard to get enough down people. And it may not be the best economic choice in terms of effect per dollar.
And the other question was about the exercise. How important is the exercise, and is weight resistance exercise helpful?
Yeah, all three of the types of exercise, resistance exercise, aerobic exercise, and stretching are all important, and they all have shown nice results in some scientific studies. Exercise is one of the key areas that in the science is shown to create the most benefit for fibromyalgia in terms of long-term comfort outcomes. Can you do it without it? Yes, because I know you can, because most people that have this are really resistant. They're very tired. The last thing they want to do is walk to the corner. They hurt. When they start to move, they hurt worse. And that's why I said a helper should come over and take their hand and lovingly help them walk to the corner and back. And it takes maybe 2, 3, 4 weeks until people really start to kind of clue into the fact that they're feeling better from the exercise. So I don't berate people about this issue. I'm just bringing it to your attention that in the science, the consensus is absolutely in the entire field that it's very important and tremendously beneficial. But the science really confirms that also.
Oh, actually, I did find one more that I think is good. Someone says that they've got kava-kava. They've tried it, but they're scared of taking it because of they've read about it being toxic to the liver. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, that's definitely a concern that's out there. I feel very comfortable using it. I've been using it, as I said, for 25 years. I've never seen a problem. That doesn't mean that the problem doesn't exist, but it appears that the problem is relatively uncommon, and I would suggest that you just be aware of it. That's why I suggested using very high-quality product. The kava extract being made in America now is being made by a process that has been improved a bit from the era when we were seeing those liver issues, and it had to do with the part of the plant that was used and the way it was processed. So I think that liver concern is over-exaggerated, although not impossible. And if you use kava high-quality products, you want to get products made from the root, not the stem. And I think probably it's well worth a trial.
And just in closing, someone said that they got a 40% improvement when they stopped using fluoride in toothpaste and medications with their fibro. So.
Well, sure, and that goes without saying that detoxifying your life is a first best step, and that's, you know, for even for someone who's lying on their couch, they can change their toothpaste, change their water source, change their food, and, you know, gradually make these changes. And it's not always going to be that dramatic, but for some people, it may be very substantially dramatic. So 40% is pretty high just for fluoride, but, you know, there's that. We talked about magnesium, that people got, you know, get complete resolution from that one thing sometimes. So really highly individual.
Yeah. KB, thank you so much for this great information. It's been an amazing amount of good suggestions and ideas. Thanks to all of you who participated in the webinar tonight. Again, it has been recorded, and we will be posting the recording at the AHG website probably sometime tomorrow or the next day. Watch for the email with the link, and hope that you will catch us on the next webinar, which we'll also send you out some information about registering for the next one, which will be on cardiovascular disease with Bibi Hernandez. So thanks, and good night.
Good night, everyone.